Dr. Campbell. I'm going to go ahead and call our meeting to order on February the 8th, year 2023, at 8:01 a.m. We basically have our roll call performed by Heather. I'll just, Dr. Campbell is present. Dr. Froman, Dr. Ivano are present telephonically. We have Seamus Monahan is present telephonically. Heather Broaddus, our executive director, is here in the board office, in the boardroom. We also have Dr. Polakoff, investigator, is present. Is Dr. Saunders on the line?
I am, hello.
Hi, Dr. Saunders. We also have Dr. Funk is present. We're waiting on his counsel. And we also have two complainants, GW and DF, on the phone. So does anyone at this time have any declarations of any conflict of interest in any of the agenda items? Hearing none, we're going to go ahead and move on to our general session minutes of January the 11th, 2023. Does anyone have any additions or corrections or comments that you would like to make about those meeting minutes? Okay, hearing none, then I will make a motion to accept our general session minutes as written for January the 11th, 2023. All right, now we're going to go ahead and move on to our items for review, the investigation. Pardon me? Oh, I'm so sorry. We did not vote on our minutes. Thank you, Heather. I made a motion. Did I have a second, please?
Second, please.
Thank you. Is there any discussion on the motion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Thank you. We'll move on to 5A, our investigation files. We're going to go ahead and do complaint 22-19-C, which is Brian Hutchinson, DPM. We do, as I mentioned, have a complainant on the line, and we have Dr. Saunders is the investigator. So at this time, I will ask Dr. Saunders for his report. Thank you.
Okay, good morning, folks. There's a complaint from Dr. Hutchinson regarding from the complaint that he has. But it appears that it was actually one of the associates that was taking care of this patient that we've seen, not Dr. Hutchinson, it was Dr. Abby, the complaint has an initial complaint that he was didn't feel he was giving appropriate care for an ulceration or a sore on the bottom of his foot. He was referred by his primary care doctor for this. Patient wasn't seen by Dr. Abbey and now Dr. Hutchinson and Punch. I put a call in for the complaint. I just wanted to make contact to discuss the case with him. I did speak with Dr. Abbey, and he confirms that he was the providing physician, not Dr. Hutchinson, at any point. Related that he was just an associate, and the patient was being referred to the office. Dr. Abbey described his care for the patient, and his written response that the patient was referred for alterations, but the amendments were performed. That the patient was improving, but then was off to some follow-up. He does describe that there were some components associated with his diabetes and with this with care. I did a chart with B, and the medical records are well organized. The patient was seen twice in the office. The patient did have some underlying immunocompromisation, including diabetes, as well. He was diagnosed with a diabetic ulceration. On the visits, the patient had some the breathings that were performed for a partial thickness ulceration, which was in the surface area of the right forefoot. The patient was also diagnosed with neuropathy as well. Dr. Addy relates that the document that there was improvement of the ulceration. Radiographs were taken, and there's no signs for new complications or infection. On the follow-up visit, patients noted that there was some improvement in the ulceration. There was just 2 digits of financials were noted to be within the standard of care. I believe that obviously Dr. Hutchinson was not involved with this case and should be taken off of this complaint. But Dr. Abbey, that provided the appropriate care for this patient, is had a diabetic ulceration. Dr. Hutchinson confirms that there was an ulcer, and it was treated appropriately. Management ongoing follow-up appointment was scheduled for the patient, but the patient decided not to keep it. I believe that the standard of care was more than satisfied for this patient. Long-term progression to prevent the recurrence of this was not established as it was ongoing at the beginning. Justification of the allegations.
Dr. Saunders, I don't have any questions. Do you have any questions, Dr. Storman or Yolanda?
This is Dr. Storman. I do have one question. Should this complaint be denied because it was the wrong doctor treating and it was made under Dr. Hutchinson and not Dr. Lobby, regardless of the treatment?
This is Tang G. Seamus. You're absolutely correct. The board can move to dismiss this matter and open a complaint and investigate Dr. Abbey, since the complaint technically is not against him, or you can just dismiss the complaint and take more action against Dr. Abbey.
Okay. Thank you. I have no more questions.
Thank you. Dr. Romano?
I have no questions.
Okay. Since we do have the complaint on, I will go ahead and ask, let me get the initials correct here, DF, if we would just summarize in about 5 minutes or less your concerns that you would like to address to the board, and then if my board members have any questions, we can ask you at that time. So please proceed.
Well, it seems like if this is kind of a big deal, it seems like y'all already made up your mind. So I'm not sure what the point of me saying anything has to do with anything. As far as the complaint was that I was being billed by Dr. Hutchinson, and, basically I went into the office, nothing was done, nothing at all. So the investigator who says that this is the standard of care, I don't know. I mean, were you there? I guess you weren't there, so I don't know how you can make these statements. The little bandage was put on my foot. It's all going back to, this is all about diabetes. Well, is it all about diabetes? Is it? Because I thought with a drug dealer in my neighborhood and I got arrested. So are you so sure that it's just all about diabetes? Because I can't think it's about stress. You know, about being falsely arrested. So I don't know, man, you guys didn't seem to think you know all about the situation. You really don't. And, I went in there twice. Nothing was done. He gave me a solid sandal to walk on, which I really don't need because I have shoes that are solid. The soles are solid, so it really didn't help me any. So as far as going for a third visit, I saw no reason to do that because what happens with the sore is, my primary care doctor said it will heal. It will not heal, okay? It gets harder and harder and harder. It gets more painful, and then at some point, I have to remove the scab. So that's just been a constant, ongoing, pattern since April last year, and, I didn't feel like I got any help at all. I went in there, I got a little bandage put on my foot, and he said, come back, you put a little bandage on my foot, and, nothing happened. I mean, I'm bleeding all over my floors, everything, because I removed the scab, I'm bleeding all over the place. So, this just seems like a weird deal. You guys already made up your mind. I complained about the wrong person. Well, we need to dismiss the complaint. Well, you know what? I didn't complain about the wrong person because I'm being billed by Dr. Hutchinson. So the complaint is towards Dr. Hutchinson. So if somebody else would have billed me, I would have complained about that person. So that's what we all have to say.
This is Dr. Campbell. How long have you been diabetic?
You know, I don't know that I really am diabetic. I spent 20 years with a Dr. Guerra over at Banner. I've always been kind of on the borderline. So Dr. Guerra retired, and then immediately, just instantly, as soon as I went over to the El Rio Center, they're like, oh, your A1C is so high. You know, it's up in the 7.2 or whatever, 7.3, 7.4 or whatever. And I'm like, well, I don't know, man. I mean, I kind of question that because, you know, I spent 20 years with Dr. Guerra, and, you know, there was only like maybe a couple times that I went over 7. So, you know, I kind of feel like it was kind of a big deal over at El Rio that they're somehow, you know, not giving me accurate information about my A1C. So, you know, I pretty much told them I'm not really going to go along with their plan, you know, because I took metformin and I almost died. Nobody wants to really hear this, but that medicine is dangerous, very dangerous. I spent 2 hours at about 1:30 in the morning. I spent from 1:30 about 3:30, almost died. Couldn't get no help, had the doctor on the phone, couldn't get no help. She had no clue what the heck was going on. So, you know, I told her, I said, I'm not doing this. I'm not a lab rat. I'm not going to be taking these medicines. You know, you prescribed another diabetes medicine. I don't know, I forget the name. I went to go pick it up, and the pharmacist said, oh, the side effect of this is a urinary tract infection. I said, well, you can forget about that. I'm not taking that medicine. And I already had somebody stick a damn tube down my wiener, and I'm not doing that again. So there's no way I'm going to go through two urinary tract infections because of incompetence. So, I feel like I'm a borderline diabetic, and, you know, what I do for that is I try to eat, you know, home-cooked meals, and, you know, that has always worked with Dr. Guerra. It's always brought my A1C down, but over here in El Rio, it doesn't seem to help at all. So, you know, we're just kind of, you know, flattening heads, because they want to say that my A1C is so bad, and it's not true. It's just not true.
Well, it sounds like there's been some very disconnecting in your care over the years. But again, Dr. Hutchinson, we're evaluating standard of care here, and Dr. Hutchinson's name may be on your bill because they're in the same office, but the doctor that took care of you is Dr. Addy. So that, because the formality of the complaint saying it's against Dr. Hutchinson doesn't match up. So I would like to know if my other board members have questions, and we thank you for giving us your summary, sir. So, Dr. Foreman, Dr. Iwano, do you have any questions?
No, I don't have any questions.
This is Dr. Iwano, I have no questions.
So, back to our options at this point, because does not appear to be any decrease or any impropriety of the standard of care issue here, but as our AAG has recommended, our options are we can dismiss the case on Dr. Hutchinson because he's not the treating physician, and then if we wish, we can open a complaint against Dr. Addy. So I'd like to know your opinions, board members.
This is Dr. Lama. I see no violation that occurred in the form of report within the community, and I vote to dismiss the case.
I agree with Dr. Lama.
Okay, so can we have a motion, please? Dr. Iwano, Dr. Chen, would you like to present a motion?
Can I motion to dismiss case 22-19-C?
We have a second. Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Thank you. All right. We'll move now on to our next case, which is 22-08-C. This is for Dr. Christopher Funk, who is present along with counsel Peter Whitaker, gentlemen, if you would like to come up. And Dr. Polakoff is here. She is the investigator on the case. This is continuation. So I'll have Dr. Polakoff proceed with her report. Thank you.
Good morning, Board. On 2208C, I have reviewed the complaint report from last time, and to summarize, my concerns are of suture removal when the sutures, when removed, did show that the skin is thin and frail from Dr. Funk's report, and that there was some not complete coaptation of the wound. On the first post-op visit, which was, surgery was on 1/19/22. The first post-op visit was 1/31/22. At the time when suture removal was performed, the patient was given another round of oral antibiotics, and it was also advised that they may get the foot wet. I find both getting the foot wet when there was some dehiscence presence of concern. I also find that the charting by Dr. Funk leaves off a lot of questions that I, as a fellow physician who would follow Dr. Funk with the records, would have a lot of questions concerning care that was or was not given because the reports are not complete. Several concerns of mine when reviewing the records was a cortisone injection was given on 12/7/21, but the patient had a past history of gout, and I'd like more information on what conservative care was given. The patient is on long-term steroid use. Why was he on long-term steroid use? I don't see labs in the report. I am aware that Dr. Funk is in a group practice, but in the record keeping, he could have reported that labs were reviewed and they do include abnormalities of such and such, or there were no abnormalities, so I have an idea about labs. I don't see an A1C on the reports, and that's about it for now. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Polakoff. Excuse me. Let me get to my right page here, because I do have a question. Okay. We did not actually have a consent form in the chart that came from the surgery center. Have you seen the consent yet?
We did have a consent that I got from Heather.
Okay, that's what I'm referring to, because that was in the original paperwork that we received from the doctor, that was not included.
Consent,
so,
yes.
Okay, because we did have consents from Dr. Hook, the physician in California that saw the patient. Gentlemen, Dr. Foreman, Dr. Ivana, do you have any questions for Dr. Polka?
I don't have any questions. No questions for Dr. Long.
Okay. All right. So at this time, I'll ask Dr. Funk or Mr. Whittakin to give a kind of opening statement, because I have a list of things I'd like to discuss when you're done.
Well, this is Dr. Funk. I just want to say my gratitude for allowing the board to let me present my side of the complaint, defend myself on that. Basically, you have all the information in front of you, and I think pretty much most of it is accurate. Basically, what this boils down to is the patient had a painful Taylor's bunion on his foot that he failed to respond by discussing, you know, modified shoes. He would come into his office visits with his bicycling shoes many times, and you know, obviously the pain got worse and worse. But he it got to the point where I did recommend that we intervene in repairing the Taylor's bunion because it was very painful. He was suffering quite a bit, and I could feel for him. And you know, in addition, I feel for the patient. Doctor never likes to see complications. I felt like I had a good relationship with this patient. But the you know, he failed to want to proceed with anything invasive, which I understand. But unfortunately, the condition got worse to where it actually ulcerated on this fragile skin that I did mention. So it went from something that we could have possibly prevented to something a little bit more serious with possible bone infection. So ultimately, the patient did go to the emergency room where they did see some erosive changes, as you have outlined in the chart. And it was, at that point, you know, my fears were osteomyelitis, and now we have an ulcer. And so the surgery went from something elective to something more aggressive, where we had to take out the fifth metatarsal head. And at that time, given the state of the patient's skin, I thought that we would attempt a primary closure by removing the ulcer. And so that was performed. Unfortunately, the skin still did not collapse. I feel that, you know, taking the sutures out, they were done one by one, and there was some irritation, but my concern was if there was infection in there, one of the last things you want to do is leave a wound closed with infection brewing in the bone. In fact, in hindsight, maybe we could have packed the wound open, but, you know, my concern was closure. Unfortunately, did not close. He already had an ulcer prior to the surgery, and so that was my line of thinking. Is, you know, let's, if there is infection, let's get the infection out. But by taking out the sutures one by one, he still had closure. But of course, it wasn't a perfectly looking wound, but it wasn't severe. But you know, led to the dehiscence of the wound and the complainant's concern, you know, his complaint now with the ulceration. So that was my line of thinking, and I felt like, you know, if there was anything outside of the standard of care, I sincerely do apologize. I do not like to see patients go through any complications, but at this point, you know, I feel that standard of care was met, and unfortunately, it was a poor outcome. But if there's anything that was of my fault, I do apologize. But at this point, that's where I stand.
Thank you, Dr. Funk. And I do apologize also. We do have the complainant on the phone. I should have allowed them to give their summary first. So we'll do that, ask the questions, and then we'll go back.
Great.
Okay, so GW, this is Dr. Campbell, board chair. So I'll ask you for summary, if you, for about 5 minutes, please, and then board members can entertain questions with you. Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to make this go on. April 21, when I saw Dr. Funk for the first time to deal with my Taylor's bunion, I had bursitis and psoriasis in the Taylor's bunion on my foot. On one tour, I returned to Dr. Funk. The infection in the right front foot had gotten worse. There was bone to bone noted by Dr. Funk, and he started me on antibiotics for the osteomyelitis. He took an x-ray and an infection. At that time, we discussed surgery to remove the metatarsal head. On 1/17, I returned to see Dr. Funk regarding the infection. But previously, the pain was so severe, I had gone to an emergency room at Royal Valley Hospital. The pain was unbearable. The x-rays were taken, a biopsy was taken at the hospital. I was given antibiotics. Dr. Funk recommended removing the head of the infected donor and scheduled me for surgery on January 19th. On 1/31/22, I returned for a post-op visit for being later. The sutures were removed. The resistance was found with lack of complete resolution. I was given my antibiotics. The suture removal was performed too soon and started the issue of the wound opening and exposing the new bone. On 2/7/22, I returned for my second post-op, Dr. Funk. At this point, I had an opening wound and I'm in extreme pain. I contacted Dr. Funk to deal with the wound and he told me to just let it heal on its own. There was wound resistance. I was given 3 stitches at the wound site and ordered wound care. I was in horrible pain. I could barely walk. The nurse came to my home, provided wound care, and it did nothing to improve my foot, and the bone was still exposed and infected. This was my last visit with Dr. Funk. On 2/8/22, I contacted Dr. Ernest Hook in Folsom, California. He looked at a picture of my room and told me the IV antibiotics, wound care, and it was very serious. There was a chance of losing my foot. So, I went to see Dr. Funk, or not Dr. Funk, Dr. Hook. On April 1st, he performed a second surgery. He removed the bone that was exposed, and he installed some stem cell material on the wound. I continued to heal over time. Eventually, we removed the stem cell material, and it's been almost a year, and my foot continues to cause me great pain. I deal with pain on a daily basis. It has been over a year since my surgery with Dr. Funk on January 19th. My proprioception is greatly compromised. Due to the removal of the fifth metatarsal head and bone in my right foot, I cannot bear weight on my foot. When I shower, I have to wear a surgical sandal on my right foot. The fat pad on my heel is gone from wearing my surgical sandal for a year. Falling in the shower has become a serious issue for me. The imbalance in my right foot has caused me very painful sciatica in my right leg and lower back. This has greatly affected my quality of life. Prior to my foot surgery, I was an avid cyclist and will most likely never ride again. That's basically my statement at this time.
Thank you, sir. I have some questions I'd like to ask you. Were you taking Enbrel when you were under the care of Dr. Funk?
No, I was not.
No, okay. And you were instructed to be non-weight bearing, and then in the record it indicates that on February the 7th you admitted that you walked on the foot. Prior to your surgery, were you offered any kind of ambulatory assisted device like a walker or a knee scooter?
No.
Now, when you saw the x-rays on the 4th with Dr. Funk, was a report read to you, or were you actually shown the x-rays and had them discussed with you?
I don't believe the report was read to me. I discussed surgery to remove the tarsal head. Took x-rays in the office, I believe. I think he did show them to me. But I had gone. Well, in the office, he had taken the x-rays, but on the 17th, that's when I went to Oro Valley Hospital and they did more x-rays on my foot.
So, do you recall having Dr. Funk indicate to you that he saw any kind of calcification of the arteries of your foot on the x-rays?
No, she did not.
So, and were you allowed to get your foot wet after the sutures were removed on the 31st of 22, January 31st?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
From what I recall, naturally, once the sutures were removed, I remember going home, and I changed my bandage. I removed the bandages, and that's when I looked down and I realized the wound was completely opened up. I had a wound the size of almost a quarter of a silver dollar in my foot.
So when Dr. Funk took out the stitches and put on the dressing, how long did he tell you? You took it off on, you made the decision yourself to take it off. When did Dr. Funk tell you you could take that dressing off?
I can't recall.
Surgical shoe at that time?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I can barely walk.
Yeah. Okay. Hang on, I've got more questions I'd like to ask you, sir. Prior to the surgery, was there any discussion? Well, I know this came, you know, any discussion about your level of nutrition as far as, you know, were you getting enough protein in your diet and things to help you to heal because of your long-standing use of the prednisone for your rheumatoid arthritis, plus I believe you're also on allopurinol for your gout?
I'm not taking allopurinol anymore.
What were you at that time?
A small amount, yes. I was having trouble with my stomach, but I was trying to continue taking it. Yes.
Okay.
And there was no discussion as far as diet or nutrition with Dr. Funk. I've always been a pretty avid cyclist mentally. I try to get my multivitamins, I try to eat right, try to keep fat out of my diet. Mm-hmm. I've always tried to do everything I can to deal with my health issues. And I'm not overweight, probably about 141 pounds. 5'9". I've always been pretty active and pretty fit.
Okay. And the other surgeries that you've had, I know that you had one on your right second toe. Have been any other surgeries? Did you ever have any trouble healing, or did you ever have any trouble with reactions to sutures? Okay. Do you have any problems with your heart or your kidneys?
No, I do not.
Okay.
I do not.
Alrighty.
Prior to getting the cycle, I was a marathoner. high level. And a few weeks before the surgery, a few months before it, I was probably riding 30 or 40 miles a day.
Have you, were you ever treated conservatively with orthotics to balance that, balance your right foot out?
Yeah. And Dr. Hook has prescribed orthotics for many years. I have soft knees, I have some stiff knees. I was putting orthotics in my cycling shoes before I would ride. And I always wear very, very good shoes. And yes, orthotics are part of my treatment plan.
Okay. Thank you for answering my questions, sir. Doctors Foreman or Ilana, do you have any questions for our complainant?
Dr. Foreman, Dr. Foreman took out the sutures. Did he tell you why he was taking them out to see if the wound was closed because of an infection?
No, he did not tell me that. I thought it was procedure to remove the sutures. It's like any other surgery. There was no talk of his concern for infection.
Okay. Thank you. Hi, Mr. Gabriel. This is Dr. Ilana. Soon after the wound was the after the sutures were removed, were you referred to a wound care facility?
And
you were referred for home health care?
Yes. We had a nurse come in and she could do absolutely nothing at that point. The wound had completely opened up. It was slowly getting worse day by day.
While you were being treated with the home health carriers, were you up and around, walking, and doing the daily activities?
So, yeah, I was barely able to walk. I was really having a hard time.
And then, seeing after the sutures is removed, how big was the wound difference?
It was probably about the size of a quarter.
It opened up right away after it was
removed. It opened up right away.
Thank you.
And that's when I contacted Dr. Hook in Folsom. I drove all the way there with my foot, the way it was, and he would run, took an x-ray and looked at me and said, "Do you see that piece of bone sticking up out of your foot? It's infected." And he said, "I'm scheduling for surgery right away." First, he performed the second surgery, and with Dr. Funk, there was no mention of a second surgery, stem cell material, any other way of healing the wound, a wound back, sending me to wound care. I was able to drive myself to California and have the second surgery. And the stem cell material was amazing. And the Warlock drugs was in the
hospital. Yes. I'm not going to talk
to you. I was just going to say, thank God, Dr. Conn Cook. I'm so blessed that he did that. And, so anyway, that's all I'm going to say.
Thank you. Did you have another question, Dr. Alano?
Yes. Prior to the surgical intervention, my doctor found that area. Did you ever get infected, or did it get infected off and on?
No. Sometimes it would get a little red and sore, but it never got to the point. It was on a point in the doctor to call our hospital.
Thank you to everyone. Now we'll go back with Dr. Funk, and I'm sure everybody remembers his recent summary. So I just want to ask a few questions, and then my fellow board members have questions. We'll entertain those then. How many x-rays did you take during your time of taking care of this patient, Dr. Funk?
It's in the record, I believe. I think just the one x-ray.
Just the one. Okay. And that was on...
Taken at the hospital.
Right. And that would have been on the... That was the one that was done on the 4th of January. Okay. And what was your... When you saw the patient post-op on 131 and you removed the stitches, the sutures... What did you put on the foot for dressing, and how long did you instruct the patient to keep that on his foot?
So I basically put 4x4 sterile gauze, Curlex, like a regular post-op dressing. Not that back up, but he was, to avoid any excessive activity, wear the post-op shoe. Just to be clear, there was not a major dehiscence when the sutures came out. There was a little irritation. They were together. You know, given the fact that he has fragile skin, each suture was taken out one by one individually. So there wasn't a big gapping wound right away, and I just wanted maybe some of the other board members to understand that there was no major dehiscence right away, but there was a little bit of irritation, and in my opinion, when you're dealing with a possible bone infection or abscess, you don't want to trap that inside the wound, but there was nothing that seeped out or, you know, it stayed closed. But still, given that, you know, it was still intact, I still wanted to keep that clean, and so I, you know, redressed it with sterile gauze, and, you know, he was instructed to keep that on there, so I don't know, by the patient taking it off on his own, that maybe something happened there that I'm not aware of.
And did you consider using any steroid strips or anything to kind of give that incision some enhancement?
In hindsight, I don't typically use steroids, but that could have been something that maybe would have given it more support, yes. That would not have been a bad...
And I didn't see documentation-wise, it said how long to keep this dressing on. So, I know that when you were seen in the ED on the 16th of January, they did, an H&P van, they did labs and stuff. Did you happen to notice that there was a moderate decrease in his GFR?
I did. I thought the urgency of the bone infection overrode that.
Okay. So was there any indicate that to an internist or his? But I know it's sketchy here too. I noticed in the records of having other physicians as part of this gentleman's care.
No, I did not consult with any other internist on that. No.
And when you, I'm going to go back here to the Mockenberg sclerosis. I know there's a lot of opinion on does it relate to atherosclerosis, but it can cause effect, obviously, with hearts and kidneys. It can decrease, the prognosis of surgical healing can be decreased by that. And I know this was an emergent situation, but when you saw that x-ray back on the 4th, did you discuss that fact with the patient and what this could mean and that there should be evaluation happen? So preoperatively with planning, at that time, because knowing the fragility of the skin, did you consider, because you were going to be taking out a metatarsal head and you're going to have a space down there that could possibly develop a hematoma, why then a biologic like, an amniotic or placental tissue be used to, enhance tissue healing, try to decrease the possibility of a hematoma? I know you discussed and said that there wasn't any evidence of, tissue fluctuance or drainage, but, and that could have helped enhance that healing of the skin. Plus, maybe nutritionally, I know, discussion of using, zinc and protein and collagen and vitamin C, anything you can to help, enhance the wound. The gentleman says he's an athlete, he tries to eat good, take his supplements, but, with the surgical stress, those things are important. And also, did you offer him a walker or any scooter, knowing that, it was going to be hard for him to stay off the foot? I believe that he said he lives alone, and that could have made it maybe easier for him to be compliant with non-weight-bearing to have had an assisted device.
Well, I think the nature of the surgery, we had discussed surgery, but we'd never formally gone over my typical preoperative planning because of the call from the emergency room. It became something where we just could not put off surgery anymore, and that's sort of took away from some of my typical preoperative discussions for that. But I think as far as nutrition, this patient, he was very on top of things as far as nutrition goes. Like he mentioned, he tried to ride a bicycle. I mean, he would come into the office with his cycling shoes on, and you know, sometimes shoes can really be the aggravating factor. But I think health-wise, although he wasn't the bastion of health, he definitely was trying to do the right thing as far as vitamin supplements and things of that nature. So, you know, we did not have a long discussion in regards to that, because we'd already discussed that earlier. And the other issue with the biologics, I mean, I don't typically throw a biologic on there for my post-op wound during surgery. I don't know if that was your question or...
Yes, it was. Yeah,
during the surgery, I did not... I thought that we would give that ulcer a chance to heal by cleaning up the margins, freshening them up, and, you know, suturing that incision together to give the body a chance to heal. Now, if it did, you know, if it did dehiss or have the complications, absolutely that would have been a consideration with biologics at that point. But I did not consider that in the operating room.
And in the office, did you ever consider any of the suture traction devices if the wound was not appropriate for a negative pressure wound therapy device?
Yeah, it's on my list of things that we do. But, I must clarify that, you know, once we got word that the wound was dehiscing to the extent that this patient, you know, he called the office, I've got to, you know, correct him in the fact that our office went in full mode, let's see what we can do to get this man help. And try to get him into the wound care center, home health, because of his, you know, he's alone at home. So we got that arranged. I mean, within the day, and, you know, it wasn't to the patient's satisfaction. And so he didn't want to pursue the things that we, you know, that we'd had planned for him if needed, that he ended up getting anyway in California. So
I understand.
Yeah, there was definitely a all hands on deck, you know, concern for this patient. So just to say that, you know, there's nothing I can do for you, absolutely that is incorrect. And, you know, we had the ball rolling, and the patient refused to abide by that. And, you know, that's his prerogative.
We all have the ability to make decisions. Personally, I mean, we all, you do surgery, you're going to have complications. We know this. We know you can't change underlying health factors. You do the best you can with everything. But I just think that some things could have been done maybe to prevent, and I realized too the time frame that was working in, you know, so that the patient was not wanting to have surgery, but it came to that point where it was a necessary thing to do. On the orthotics, that's why I was curious if you had ever done anything with those. He did say Dr. Hook had him in orthotics, if that was anything you had thought of prior, or if this was going to be something that was down the line.
Well, orthotics, just to answer that question, he already had orthotics. I felt that the concern and the focus was the shoe gear, because he had orthotics, but, you know, orthotics inside of a tight cycling shoe is not ideal. You know, cycling shoes are not
very
conducive to orthotics, and when you take up any more room in there with this prominent fifth, you know, Taylor's bunion, I can actually aggravate it more. So I think, you know, the focus was on shoe gear. That was never really changed, you know, from what I saw with the patient. And so I think that was really the underlying factor of what was going on there.
Mm-hmm. And as far as, I have just a couple of remarks about some documentation issues I saw. There was one area on a visit, that was the January the 4th visit. You only documented the left pedal pulsus, not the right. Now, later on in your records, you do have the right and the left documented. And curiosity got me in your op report when you talk about the perlearns around the fifth med head, but you don't mention in there that you took cultures and bone, sent your bone to path, but then later, yes, there we see, there are the reports. So I just think, you know,
clarifying that those that your op report shows. Yes, I did this.
That's correct. I should. So, yeah,
I would, just a point of information, because that makes it clear. Obviously, for somebody like a reviewer or another physician can pick it up and say, yes, this is what they did. I'm going to look for this in the rest of the chart.
I'm actually surprised it's not in there.
Yeah.
That's standard, yes.
Right. And I didn't see anything preoperatively in the chart that said, the patient consented. We discussed the surgical procedures. What I'm assuming is throughout time, there were little bits of conversation, but there was no specific preoperative consent visit. Yes, and we do find that you have the consent from in the hospital chart for the surgery and for the anesthesia. So,
I guess I would respond to that. You're absolutely right. The consent process was somewhat fast forwarded once we got the call from the emergency room. It was like, we got to get this done now. Infection can travel up the bone. And so that's.
And tendons.
Yeah, that's not something that. Obviously, we need a consent. So.
Thank you. Dr. Foreman or Dr. Ilana, do you have any questions for Dr. Funk?
Dr. Foreman. Dr. Funk, did you talk to the patient about a LUMAC or anything else if it exists based upon
I'm not sure if I spoke to him in specifically about a wound back because when we got the call with the wound dehiscing, the focus at that point was post-operative management immediately. So that's why we got the wound care center involved and the home health center. But yeah, should it not, it wasn't a major wound at that point, but certainly a KCI wound. Something to consider had I been able to stay with the patient a little bit longer than what I had.
That's the only question I have. Thank you.
Thanks. Dr. Ilana.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Funk. How many post-op visits did you realize that the listens was going bad?
Can you repeat the question?
After the first doctor of the list. When did you notice that the list was getting out of hand or getting bad?
It was actually from the patient's phone call. So when I first saw it, when we took the sutures out, there was no big wound dehiscence. It was a little bit red, a little bit irritated, but there was no wound dehiscence or drainage at that time. So, really when I came to know about it was when the patient called.
Okay. When you found out about it, what did you do to help the patient?
Boy, I explained, to the patient that this was definitely a complicated situation that we needed to get 20, once a day wound care, given his history of, his medical condition and history. So, we tried to, get the wound care center involved and got special approval for that because they weren't on the insurance, and then the home health because you couldn't get to the wound care center. I could let him discuss why he was unable to go to those appointments or why he was dissatisfied with that. But, we definitely tried to, take a serious approach and treatment on this patient.
Okay, thank you. No further question.
Thank you. So I will try to wrap this up. Again, I don't think that there was no malicious intent or anything that happened in this case. Definitely, dealing with a high-risk patient, as we all know, has a lot of limitations, and there's always a chance for complication and problems. I think that things could have been done preoperatively and perioperatively, postoperatively to help the patient sooner. I know they were on a time frame. Obviously, we've heard about,
the emergence of the situation, but this had been going on for a while also. So I don't believe that it warrants a disciplinary action, but I would want to...
I apologize for interrupting, but since you're going to be able to know that you have...
Oh, certainly, and I apologize, Mr. Whitaker. I should have re-asked you if you had remarks.
I just make a few points. The surgery was essentially an emergent surgery on January 19th. There were two follow-up visits. The first one was on January 31. That's when the sutures were removed. He discussed what he saw, what he did. The next... and only additional visit, Dr. Yolanda, directly to your point, was when the patient came back on February 7th. We now know, and the patient has confirmed, that during that time he had taken off the dressing. We acknowledged, and it's consistent with records, that he had been walking on the foot. But these things happen. But the dehiscence was immediately recognized. And I do have to take issue with the patient's statement that during that last visit, Dr. Funk essentially sent him on his way. There were multiple attempts, ultimately successful on that day, to coordinate a same-day referral for wound care at the wound care clinic at Northwest Hospital. This is there, it's immediately recognized. The patient did not find that attractive, apparently because of transportation. The next, but at the same time, Dr. Funk's office coordinated home health care. Various insurance issues, they got that coordinated. The patient allowed two visits from the home care nurse and then refused any additional treatment. There were additional documented efforts in the record by Dr. Funk's office to get the patient back in. I thought it somewhat striking that the patient said he called Dr. Hook, I believe, on February 22nd or thereabouts. Dr. Hook apparently told him, you need to be on IV antibiotics for infection that Dr. Funk wasn't aware of, or you might lose your foot. And so the patient went to Dr. Hook more than a month later. Without significant antibiotic treatment in the interim. But this was not a case where the patient came in with a dehiscence and then followed the wound care regimen and followed up with Dr. Funk. The patient was the one who went on his way. Dr. Funk didn't send him on his way.
Thanks. All right, so I will... Does anybody, before we go back to the, where we were, anybody have any further comments or questions on from the board for either counsel or the doctor? Okay, hearing none. So I would say, you know, about what's going on, the fact that we all know the complications happen, especially in high-risk patients, but that things could have been done to enhance things. Of course, we have hindsight here, and time frames, we do have an issue of some compliance issues, et cetera, et cetera. That's why I feel it does not rise to any level of a disciplinary action. So options I see at this point, or maybe some non-disciplinary CMEs, discussion of surgical methods or other methods to enhance healing in high-risk patients, patient communication, documentation, those kind of issues, or submitting a letter of concern regarding those same issues. So, like opinion and thoughts from my board members.
This is Dr. Lama. I'd like to see non-disciplinary CMEs. I don't think this doesn't arise to negligence or standard of care below the standard of care.
Mm-hmm. I would like to point out, I agree with the CMEs. I do feel as though they're not doing standard of care, and
So, gentlemen, would you find it appropriate for 2 hours in each of the categories that I listed?
Yes.
And then we'll follow the, you know, the standard verbiage that this is in addition to the regular 25 hours of CME for licensure, that the courses have to be board approved, that it's 6 months to completion of signing the non-disciplinary CME. And the submission or acceptance is what, 30 days, correct? 30, yeah. So does anybody have anything to add to that?
No.
Okay.
May I ask, Heather, I think we use it for the
Alrighty, so let's, is there any discussion then on that, or do I have a second? Do I have a second, please? Thank you. Any other discussion on the motion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Heather, we'll back up the specific categories.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Okie dokie. Let's move on to B, which is the issuance of licenses. We have two applications for licensure. I'm going to try not to butcher Dr. Braden Berklichuk. This is a regular license application. Everything is in place in his application. Of course, that includes initial registration for drugs and devices. Does anybody have any questions or concerns on this application? Okay, hearing none, I will make a motion to accept, approve the application for his initial project. Podiatry license and registration for dispensing drugs and devices as it's complete and meets statute, fees are paid, and then to issue the license upon payment of the license issuance fee.
Okay.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Our next is Dr. Pierre Desrosiers. This is also a regular license. Fees are paid. Everything is within statute and materials all sent. Does anybody have any questions or concerns there? Then I will make a motion to approve the application for licensure from Dr. DeRozier's and to issue the license upon payment of the issuance fee.
Second.
Any discussion? Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. All right, we'll move on here now to the initial analysis with Dr. J. David Brown. I'm going to have Heather discuss this.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, Board members. The Board Office received email communication regarding Dr. David Brown, and some of the documentation does allege that Dr. David Brown is practicing in Arizona without a license. Some of that documentation is referrals from other health providers, explanation of benefits, and so forth. The individual who submitted this documentation did request to remain anonymous. So I did send documentation to Dr. David Brown, and I did include, I should back up just a little bit. Dr. David Brown did voluntarily surrender his license in 2017, which is also considered like a disciplinary revocation. So I did speak with Dr. Brown, and he did submit a response. And he denies practicing in Arizona. He claims that he's been living out of state for the last 5 years, taking care of his elderly parents. And so the board can either take no action on this. It can, if the board determines that he is practicing or without a license, can order a cease and desist be sent to him. So with that, I can answer any questions.
Hi, my name is Dr. Foreman. Is there any way we can actually go to Dr. David Brown, MD, and see if it's him that they're talking about, like Dr. Brown, podiatrist, said in his response?
And Dr. Foreman, I do believe that Dr. Brown, the respondent, did indicate that, you know, there is another MD, Dr. Brown, in the Valley, and that there may be some confusion there. I did not try contacting Dr. Brown, MD, but I could if the board wishes me to do so. And I just would like to note, too, that on some of the documentation that was received by the board office, the documentation does have the credentialed DPM behind Dr. Brown's name, not MD.
Yeah, that's the only reason I would want to double-check before we open up the case.
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when people are in practice for long, it seems like you can't get this stuff off of the social media sites or any sites. Their names stay on some, you know, on a practice forever and a day. And Madam Chair, board members, if I may, Dr. Campbell is correct in that, you know, whenever because I did perform some Google searches on Dr. Brown, DPM, and a lot of his old practices, you can still find those on the internet. And as Dr. Campbell mentioned, it's almost impossible to remove that information from the internet. So there could be some confusion there as well. You know, Dr. Brown was in practice for 20 plus years, and it appears that the information that's being sent to the practice, you know, the fax number hasn't changed, phone numbers haven't changed, that kind of information has not changed since Dr. Brown sold the practice.
You know, and one of the things that Dr. Brown was bringing up was he feels like somebody, you know, that there's, you know, all these false accusations. And I think I would, you know, just suggest we, you know, if anything else comes through, you know, just kind of hold this and monitor the situation to see if anything comes up. Because if I, you know, tend to agree with, you know, that Dr., you know, he's taking care of his mom and dad, so... He's not even here in the state.
And why would he have a picture of him in practice?
And Madam Chair, board members, if I may, I did have a phone conversation with Dr. Brown, and it was before my time. Dr. Campbell may remember, but the same situation occurred about 4 or 5 years ago, and it doesn't appear that the board took any action at that time.
So I think Dr. Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
I think you before the week.
Yeah. Dr. Imano, do you have any thoughts?
Sure. I believe that that's Dr. Brown went to the station. I would say that if there is further evidence that someone changing his identity or changing his practice, but I don't feel any of it.
Okay. So sure we don't need to do anything with that. We'll just keep it. I don't need any motions for that. No, I don't think so.
Madam Chair, board members, if I may ask Seamus, if we need any sort of motion on this item, if the board just wants to continue to monitor, do they have to take any sort of action today?
I'm going to
go. Okay, that's what I thought.
All right, you're up, Seamus, for review and discussion regarding training and overview of policies, procedures on conflicts of interest.
Okay, do you really want to start to pull this up?
This is part of the required board training, so we're going to be doing a topic per month till Sheena says we're done.
Okay, well, I'm doing this up. I'll just jump in here a little. So, conflict. I'm not sure that we've ever had a discussion about conflicts before. But conflicts are important for recusals, bias, predetermination, determining facts based on their own cases, on the facts that are presented to you, not doing extra research, not having information about a matter that other members don't have. And why it's important, it's important for a lot of reasons, but specifically too, at the committee meetings for the boards you had their sunset reviews just this past month, the committees were very concerned with the boards providing training, and that the board members were announcing their conflicts, putting them on the record, and just making it very clear whether they have a conflict or not, and if they need to recuse themselves. I think it's a little self-evident of why the committee would be concerned with those issues. Conflict of interest law is found under Arizona Revised Statute Section 38503. And the pertinent parts mean any public officer or employee of a public agency who has or whose relative has a substantial interest in any contract, sale, purchase, or service to such public agency shall make known that interest in the official records of such public agency, and shall refrain from voting upon or otherwise participating in any manner as an officer or employee in such contract, sale, or purchase. And then B, any public officer or employee who has or whose relative has a substantial interest in any decision of a public agency shall make known such interest in the official records of such public agency, and shall refrain from participating in any manner as an officer or employee at such agency. And so what A and B are discussing here
is the difference between a statutory conflict and a non-statutory conflict. A non-statutory conflict is going to be something that's not pecuniary, right? If it's a statutory conflict, then it's usually going to involve your, a family member that's before the board, or somebody that you have a financial interest with, and that, both in one way or the other could hurt or help that individual's financial interest. And so, just remember that whenever you have, a financial interest or a family member involved in a matter, or an extended family member, that's the time when you're just always going to want to recuse. And you can always ask me about it, if you think maybe I have a conflict, doesn't feel like it's statutory, maybe it feels like you have an indirect conflict, or you serve, or an association with somebody. That's the other situation where it's up to you whether you think that you can be impartial. And I think that Dr. Campbell has on, on more than one occasion, said on the record, I know this individual, I worked with them, or I went to school with them, but I don't know them, but in that case, I can do this case without any issues. And again, why that's important is all board members need to have the exact same information when they come to a meeting to determine the matter. And that information is the information that's provided to them by the board. And you guys know that. No, the personal is, Googling and looking up, licensees or issues about them on the internet, as an aside to an investigation, just remember to base your determination on what's in the packet and what's provided from the investigator and from Heather. The purpose. The object of the conflict of interest statutes is to remove or limit the possibility of personal influence which might bear upon an official's decision. Arizona conflict of interest law serves to prevent self-dealing by public officials. The financial interest of public officers or employees must not conflict with the unbiased performance of their public duties, because one cannot serve two masters with conflicting interest. Public officials should avoid situations where their professional or financial concerns might conflict with the unbiased performance of their duties. The statute is thus directed not only at dishonor, but also at conduct that tempts dishonor. This broad prescription embodies a recognition of the fact that an impairment of impartial judgment can occur even in the most well-meaning men and women when their personal economic interests are affected by the business they transact on behalf of the government. And if you ever have a specific question about, if you have, you think you have a conflict, you have an issue that's not a statutory conflict, so it doesn't require recusal, but you're just wondering if it creates the air of impropriety, if it makes, if it exposes, the board to possibly arguments that, an individual member is not impartial in hearing the case. There's other ones too, which, it may feel odd, but you may read a case and be so angry, or when you hear something on the internet, on the newspaper about a certain case, and you're just so angry about it that you can't unbiasedly determine whether a violation occurred, because you just feel so emotional about the situation as it is. That may be the time when you need to recuse yourself. If you truly think that you cannot be unbiased in that determination, and you can always talk to me about it. You can bounce these things off me or Heather, and I would prefer that if you do, when you have a question, to not ask for a
a legal session, an executive session for us to discuss these issues, but rather just come up before the meeting, maybe a couple days before the meeting, and we can have that discussion off the record. And you know, the real important thing here is that you're never going to hear me say, you know, as your attorney, I'm making you recuse. You know, it will discuss the issue, you know, discuss the potholes in the road, and then, you know, it really will be always your decision whether you think that you should recuse yourself or not. So generally, a board member has a conflict of interest in a case to be brought before it must disclose that interest and recuse themselves from participating in the proceeding. Conflict of interest laws prohibit participation by a public officer or employee in a decision or contract which the public officer or employee has a direct or indirect pecuniary or proprietary interest. The purpose of the law is to remove or limit the possibility of personal influence which might bear upon an official's decision. A board member who has or whose relative has a substantial interest in any decision of the board has a conflict of interest as defined by law and must publicly disclose that interest and recuse from participating in the matters in question. You know, just as an aside, I was seeing that come up before where, you know, a family member of a board member owns a facility, and that facility is also regulated by the board. And they have to come before the board for an issue, and then that member of the board will then recuse themselves because they have the ability to affect that monetary, that financial interest in one way or the other. Substantial interest, you've heard that a lot. That's substantial interest is where that, you know, that heightened scrutiny comes in when you're looking at it yourself. That substantial interest is going to make you think, okay, probably statutory. It's probably a requirement that I recuse. So that's when your substantial interest comes in. Almost always means a pecuniary or proprietary interest. Either direct or indirect. My relative means spouse, child, parent, grandparent, sibling, or in-law of the board member. Disqualification is automatic and mandatory when statutory conflict of interest exists. And again, automatic and mandatory just means, again, these are your decisions. We're not going to try to read your mind or, you know, determine all the facts ourselves when it comes to your conflict. So it really is important that you fully disclose all your conflicts and that you're upfront with the other board members. Board member must make conflict of interest in any board decision known in the board's official records. You file either a written document with the board disclosing the interest or file a copy of the official number of the board meeting, which discloses the interest. And I'm pretty sure, Heather, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but with this board, generally, if you have a conflict, you state on the record, state what the conflict is, that you're accusing yourself, and then Heather will, even at that meeting, Heather will have you sign a conflict sheet that just memorializes what the conflict was and what agenda item, which will then go into the board's files. And which, my understanding is, the auditors going forward in any sunset review will be scrutinizing those pretty closely. Disqualified board member must not communicate in any manner with anyone involved in the decision-making process. So, if somebody is recused, make sure that, you know, either on the record, off the record, you are not discussing the matter with them. You are completely walled off from that situation. Consequences for violating conflict of interest laws. Reversal of board's decision due to undisclosed conflict of interest, that could be in the regularity of a proceeding. So even if we went through a formal hearing and later found out that there was a conflict of interest, then it most likely be reversed on appeal. Civil lawsuit filed against the board and a board member to enforce the conflict of interest laws. And if it's a board member who knows they have a conflict and they don't, in almost all those situations, I will not be able to represent you individually. You'll have to go out and hire an attorney of your own in order to take care of that situation. criminal prosecution. Now, I believe there is a... it is a felony, and I can't remember which designation. It's felony 4 or felony 5 for violating conflict of interest laws. And it really depends on, what the damage is, what happens to these individuals, what the outcome is because of that conflicted vote. And the other thing that's not in here, which you should really think about too, is that now that this is on everybody's radar, these conflict notices that the board signed, well, public record, they can be requested, and let's say somebody, or the news knows that, something about you, that the board does it, and, you don't disclose it, there's always that situation where, you may be called out by somebody in the public or somebody in the media. I've seen it happen before with boards, so it's just important to remember that, even if you don't think people are going to know that you have these conflicts, somehow they seem to find out. Public officials shall not use or attempt to use the official position to secure any valuable thing or valuable benefit for himself, which he or herself, which would not otherwise receive in ordinary performance of either her duties, if the thing or benefit might have a substantial and improper influence upon them, as we kind of discussed already. Public official may not directly or indirectly receive compensation for his participation on the board in addition to what is authorized by law. And that's just really done accepting gifts or any kind of monetary, even money or gifts from members of the public based on your work here. But in one situation that could happen is you get invited to speak at an association event, and you get a gift bag. So just make sure you understand that could be a conflict, and that whoever gave it to you, whoever is responsible for that, if they come before the board for board business, then you want to put that on the record. Bias, prejudice, and predetermination. So this is the other side of the conflicts coin. Conflicts are a little more concrete than bias, prejudice, and predetermination. These three words really encompass, the more behind-the-scenes work that you do. And so even though a board member may not have a conflict of interest, he or she may need to disqualify themselves from participating in a matter coming before the board because they have bias or prejudice. It would be unacceptable for this board member to participate in this manner because it would be interfering with the licensee's right to due process and to have a fair hearing. Bias and prejudice occur in situations where a board member's mind may already have been made up on the matter, or the board member may have information that other board members do not have also. And again, that's one of the important things. Let's say somebody reaches out to you and says, hey, I have a case before the board, and sends you a document that the board doesn't have. The first thing you're going to want to do is send that information you received directly from the individual. Send that to Heather and say, please don't communicate with me anymore about this issue. And I believe that we have had that come up before with this board, in which, our board member did. And so keep on the record that they're not going to be accused, and that the individual had, misrepresented the nature of the conversation with the board member. So that's one of those situations that kind of causes me bias, prejudice, and predetermination. Board members, as we discussed, board members should disqualify themselves if they entertain strong feelings about the specific facts of the case, which will influence their opinion regardless of the evidence. Disqualification from the case means that the board member will not participate in the discussion or voting on the case. This non-participation is called recusal. And then also, on your end of that, we really request that if you know that you have a conflict with the matter, that you let her know, and that you make sure that you do not review the materials, because it's not every, you know, the board will always know in sending out the material if you have a conflict in a certain matter. And so it's really up to you to say, hey, you know, I have a conflict in this, I promise I will review or disseminate any of the materials in the packet related to that case. Even if the board member believes that they have, you know, actual bias or prejudice about specific facts in a particular case, they should consider the appearance of fairness and disqualify themselves if participation may give the appearance of impropriety. The following circumstances alone generally do not constitute appearance of impropriety. However, the board member should make an independent inquiry into specific facts with potential appearance of impropriety. For example, is this an individual that the board member has an attenuated professional acquaintanceship with, or is the individual a close friend? For example, is the committee a general school committee, or is the individual in a leadership position over a board member on the committee? Can you claim with the individual, serving on committees with the individual? Just things to think about. And again, you probably will have cases where it involves somebody that you know or somebody that you serve on the committee with. And, you know, the way to cure that appearance of impropriety is you just make it very clear on the record that you do know this person and that it's not going to affect you if it isn't, and that you can judge this case impartially as you do any other matter. And that's kind of the language, the magic language you're going to say when you put that on the record. You know, and then ex parte communication just comes, again, we've had experience with this, with people reaching out to board members and trying to discuss matters with them that are going to come before the board. Generally, an ex parte communication is an oral or written communication between the decision maker and one party to a proceeding in the absence of the other party, e.g. the other board members. Ex parte communication being proper must be avoided by all board members. Board members are decision makers and they must remain impartial to make a fair decision. And ex parte communication could be as simple as, you know somebody that's coming before the board and you both go in person, and before the meeting you walk over to the gallery and say hi to them. And they bring up the case and they say something about their case, and now we've got an ex parte communication that needs to be put on the record. So another good reason to refrain from mingling with the people, the licensee in the gallery. So usually ex parte communications related to the subject of bias or prejudgment. Ex parte communications may indicate a bias or prejudgment that takes the decision-making process. In general, ex parte communication in an administrative proceeding is communication between the decision-maker and one side of a dispute or third parties in the absence of other party or parties. It may include communication about a board member between a board member and a licensee, complainant or applicant, or other person that occurs outside the public board meeting without all parties present. It includes license application matters and contested cases. Generally speaking, a board member may not initiate, permit, or consider communications made outside the presence of the parties regarding a pending or impending proceeding. This is really discussed. You don't want to have any information going into a matter that the other board members don't. Everybody should be basing their decision on the exact same information. Ex parte communication with the decision maker is prohibited because it impugns the integrity of the decision making process and gives the appearance of favoritism, suggesting bias or partiality on the part of the decision maker, deprives the advocate party of the right to respond and be heard, can be misleading because it exposes the decision maker to one sided arguments which carries the attendant risk and erroneous ruling in the law of facts. The board can act only through a majority of a quorum at a public meeting. All board members should have the same information about a board matter. The reason for the strict rule against ex parte communication is that the opportunity to bias is minimized if all parties are present whenever any evidence or argument is being presented to the decision maker. An advocate in a licensed denial hearing and a licensee in a contested case hearing matter are entitled by law to have the board decide their cases based on the evidence presented at hearing and not by outside ex parte communications. The board members' ex parte communications may, in some instances, constitute a violation of the due process rights of the licensee or violate the open meeting law. And possible consequences of that ex parte communication, the board's final decision may be reversed on appeal. If the ex parte communication violates open meeting law, it may nullify board action taken in violation of the law or subject the commissioner in question to civil penalty, or in some instances, removal from office. And in some instances, if the ex parte communication is between board members, awkwardly enough, you may have to read your emails or your statements into the record at the next meeting if you do end up having an ex parte conversation. Again, the relevant statutes under Chapter 3, Article 8, the Section 3501, that's the application of the conflict of laws, conflict of interest for officers and employees. Title 2 is your definitions, which includes other, the board, any of the board investigators. And then 38509 is the filing of disclosures, which as we discussed is very important. It appears that what the committee is going to see is full-throated disclosure on the record and that document being signed that way the public can know exactly what the conflicts are and there's no questions about it. That being said, that's all I have. If anybody has any specific questions, I would ask that you email those to me so that we don't get into any hypotheticals today. But if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you, Seamus. What's our topic next month?
Next month we're going to do open meeting law.
Oh.
We have a big one.
Yeah, cool. Okay.
We may not do anything after that. And in the month after that, we'll do determination of cases and motions.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Okay. So, as Seamus said, if you have questions, email him. Now we have Heather's Executive Director's Report.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, board members. At its August 10th, 2022 meeting, the board issued a non-disciplinary order for continuing education to Dr. Daniel Bangert in resolution of complaint number 20-18-C. And on January 18th, 2023, and in consultation with the board chair, Dr. Bangert was released from the non-disciplinary order as he had completed the terms of the order. I also do have an update on the new database. Three of the four portals went live last Wednesday afternoon. So if you look on our website now, there's a tab that says online services. If you go to that tab, you'll see three different portals. One is for the public registry. There's an applicant portal, so applicants can now create an account and submit applications online. And there's a complaint portal. So Ventia is still working on configuring the renewal portion of the database, so the licensee portal could not go live yet. I'm hoping that within the next 3 to 4 weeks we'll be able to go live with that. It will be done in plenty of time before renewals, so name changes, address changes, things of that nature, a licensee can still find those forms on our website or they can email me. So I will keep the board updated on that. And I submitted the current budget. I can answer any questions on that, as well as the complaint log. Since I sent out board materials, I have not added any new complaints to the complaint log.
Alrighty, so then we'll move ahead. Any questions for Heather? Okay, so now let's move on to our legislative update and discussion.
Yes, Madam Chair, board members, there's not as many bills this session as there have been the last few, but I will review all of them and try to be pretty brief. There's House Bill 2157, and that's relating to the limitation of actions for medical malpractice actions. It's going to impose a five-year limitation. So that may affect this board, as this board is required to open a complaint if it receives an NPDB report regarding a malpractice claim. And all of these bills were just introduced, so they've not gotten very far in the process yet. So that one is still awaiting a third read. And then House Bill 2190 relating to health professions. This has to do with boards' websites and the information that a board has to make available on its website. So there are some things that this board would have to change, such as including the employer's name, and it also requires letters of concern be placed on the board's website. Things of that nature that the board has never had posted before. So I will keep the board updated on that. And then there's House Bill 2144 and Senate Bill 1020. They're basically the same bill. And this was introduced last year, too, but did not pass. And it just requires the board to make sure that there is enough seating for the attendees at a board meeting as feasible. And then there's Senate Bill 1078, and the board should be familiar with this bill. It's the bill that the State Association is running, and there was a Senate Health and Human Services mini-meeting last Tuesday, January 31st, that Mr. Abadi and I attended, and it did pass unanimously. And yesterday, it went to the Senate Rules Committee, and it passed unanimously. So then the next step will be to go to the Committee of the Whole. And then as long as it passes that, then it'll be transmitted to the House. So I'll keep the board updated on that. And then Senate Bill 1087 relating to professions and occupations. This bill was also introduced a few sessions ago, and it basically requires a board to waive renewal and licensing fees one time if their fund is going to exceed 50% of appropriation in the current fiscal year. So I'll keep the board updated on that. And there's SB 1239. This is relating to control of receipts and expenditures. So this just states that a board may enter into a contract to accept cryptocurrency. There's SB 1333 relating to the Department of Health Services, and this requires the Department of Health Services to establish a database that posts any license verifications, and the board each regulatory board will be required to report that information to the Department of Health Services, and it does have a time frame on it. It's beginning July 1st of 2019 to July 1st of 2024, so only those revocations within that time frame from the way it reads. And then there's SB 1386, and this requires all regulatory boards or agencies to not charge any fees for applications, initial licenses, license renewal, temporary licenses, or examinations to the licensee for fiscal years 2023 to 2024 and 2024 to 2025. This bill does have a stipulation that if a board is going to be in a deficit, it can request funds from the treasurer's office if needed. And then the last bill is SB 1639, and this bill was also introduced. I don't remember if it was last session or the session before, but it did not pass, and it just requires each state agency to employ tribe liaison from a recognized tribe to represent and facilitate communications between each state agency. And other bills may come up as the session goes on, and I will keep the board updated on all of those bills. And I'm available to answer any questions.
Do you guys have any questions? Thanks, Heather. Alrighty, so summary of current events. Don't believe anybody that we don't have any in the category. We have our call to the public, which the public has no longer here. Does anybody have any agenda items they'd like to see future items that items agenda items for future meetings? I'm sorry. Okay. So, but if you have anything, always please don't hesitate to contact Heather. Our next board meeting is the 8th of March, 23. And I will ask one more time, any other comments, questions, concerns? Good, none, then I will move to adjourn the meeting at 8:52 a.m. Oh, I'm sorry, 9:52. Oh, boy, I'm on somebody else's time zone today. Anyway, so I have a second. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye, guys.
Bye.